KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
I realized that my actions would potentially cross extreme ethical and legal lines.
21 employees resigned from the Department of Government Efficiency in protest. We hear from one of them.
For Thursday, February 27th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. The FDA has canceled an upcoming meeting about vaccines.
The committee was supposed to make recommendations about next year's flu vaccines.
Well, it's disappointing that they canceled this advisory committee meeting. We have met every March for the last decade and longer.
And today, workers at the U.S. Agency for International Development cleared out their desks.
For USAID, 11 years. As a Fed, 36 years. Didn't think I'd be ending my career like this.
And we hear from some of the youngest champions of NPR Student Podcast Challenge.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Speer. A federal judge in San Francisco is ordering a temporary and partial halt to the Trump administration's mass firing of probationary employees. As NPR's Andrew Hsu explains, the order affects some, but not all, agencies that have carried out mass firings in recent weeks.
Several labor unions and civic organizations sued the Trump administration, saying its Office of Personnel Management had violated the law by ordering agencies to fire probationary employees en masse. In court, the government argued that it was merely an ask, not an order. U.S. District Judge William Alsup rejected that argument, noting that the firings happened suddenly and across so much of the government. Because of standing issues, he issued only partial relief to those agencies whose firings affect the civic groups that joined the lawsuit. They include the VA, the Small Business Administration, the National Park Service, the National Science Foundation, and others. He scheduled another hearing in 2 weeks. Andrea Hsu, NPR News.
New FBI Director Kash Patel is suggesting the Bureau partner with the Ultimate Fighting Championship in an effort to enhance physical fitness at the FBI. UFC is popular mixed martial arts fighting league run by a close supporter of President Trump's. More from NPR's Ryan Lucas.
FBI Director Kash Patel made the statement during a weekly call with the leaders of the Bureau's 55 field offices. A person familiar with the matter told NPR that Patel said the FBI will partner with the Ultimate Fighting Championship. The director did not provide any details on what any partnership between UFC and the FBI would entail. FBI agents are trained at the Academy in Quantico, Virginia, a course that includes intensive training in physical fitness and defensive tactics. The head of UFC is Dana White, who has close ties to President Trump. A UFC spokesperson says White knows Patel too, but that the company is unaware of any information regarding UFC and FBI training. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, Washington.
Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is asking the Justice Department to clarify if she or her office are under investigation. She spoke with NPR's Steve Inskeep about a Trump administration official referring to her to the DOJ.
The New York Democrat held an online seminar encouraging constituents to know their rights. And that attracted attention from President Trump's border czar. Tom Homan told Fox News he asked the Justice Department if she was helping immigrants without legal status to avoid deportation. Ocasio-Cortez told me she intended to ask the Justice Department about it herself.
I think it's important to call this administration's bluff. I think that this is what authoritarians do. I think this is what kleptocracies do. They rely on the illusion of power.
She then sent a letter, which she shared with NPR, asking the Attorney General if she had, quote, yielded to political pressure to investigate elected officials. Steve Inskeep, NPR News.
On Wall Street, the Dow was down 193 points today. This is NPR. Egypt says negotiations between Israel and Hamas on the next phase of a ceasefire in Gaza are now underway in Cairo. According to Egypt's state-run information service, Israel, the U.S., and Qatar started intensive discussions on the second phase of a ceasefire. Earlier in the day, an Israeli official had said its military will not withdraw from a strategic corridor in the Gaza Strip. Those remarks came hours after Hamas released the bodies of four hostages in exchange for 600 Palestinian prisoners. Public health officials in North Texas are monitoring the spread of measles after a case was confirmed in a Dallas area suburb this week. Kelly Broussard from member station KERA in Dallas has more.
Texas public health officials say the measles case out of Rockwall County is not related to the more than 130 cases reported in West Texas and New Mexico. But local health officials are bracing themselves for more. Dr. Philip Wong with Dallas County Health and Human Services says he's reached out to school superintendents in districts with lower vaccination rates.
The vaccination is very effective, and so fortunately, that's something that we have to try to make sure that we continue to keep the measles a rare thing in our community.
Health leaders in neighboring Tarrant County are working on a plan to address measles if cases are reported there. For NPR News, I'm Kaylee Broussard in Arlington, Texas.
Carnival season is winding down in New Orleans and along the Gulf Coast with big parades rolling down the main routes as participants don their fancy costumes. Three parades are scheduled to roll through the city tonight with scores of masked riders and colorful floats. More processions will be continuing every day through Mardi Gras or Fat Tuesday. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include American Jewish World Service, committed to the fight for human rights, supporting advocates and grassroots organizations worldwide working towards democracy, equity, and justice at ajws.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. There was a time when federal government work was shorthand for a safe and predictable job. Not anymore. Today, federal government employees face drama, uncertainty, and conflict, coming largely from the Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE. President Trump and DOGE leader Elon Musk are trying to shrink the size and scope of the federal workforce. The department carrying out this mission is a decade old and had hundreds of employees, previously known as U.S. Digital Service. On Tuesday, 21 of those employees resigned in protest. In an anonymous letter, they said, quote, "We will not use our skills as technologists to compromise core government systems, jeopardize American sensitive data, or dismantle critical public services." Well, our next guest is one of those people, and because she's worried about retaliation for speaking out, we've agreed to use only her first and middle initials, DK. She told me everything changed the day after the inauguration.
On January 21st, we were all required to attend 15-minute interviews with people who only identified themselves as DOGE and their first names. At that point, it was unclear if these were government employees or not. And after those interviews, we got the response of no comment on whether our projects should change. And so it was a time of extreme uncertainty, but we tried to stay focused on the projects. And I know for me, try and just continue the work for as long as I could.
So this resignation letter says people who arrived with DOGE fired technical experts, mishandled sensitive data, and broke critical systems. Can you give us an example of an instance you saw that happen?
Yeah, there are quite a few. One of the big ones, and there has been information that has come out that is incorrect, is in regards to the Social Security Administration. The access to that data contains all the information on any person who has ever been eligible for Social Security. It doesn't mean that it's somebody who is actively receiving Social Security, and perhaps it could be somebody who passed away quite a long time ago. That data, not only is it being utilized incorrectly, but the access to it and the feeding it into other systems makes all of that data and all of the American people's data very insecure.
How would you respond to people who say, well, these are disaffected Democrats who are heading for the exits?
I would say that is a gross mischaracterization of the United States Digital Service as a whole. While we were founded during the Obama administration, United States Digital Service still operated during the first Trump administration and was able to do good work during that time. We cover the gambit as far as our political leanings, and part of being an EOP employee and the oath that we swear to the Constitution when we start is to operate in a nonpartisan, nonpolitical way. We are here to serve the American people. It is not a political issue.
You could have chosen to stay and try to work within the system. What was the tipping point that made you decide leaving was the best choice?
The first real tipping point came when many of my colleagues were fired for seemingly no reason, when they had been performing exceptionally at their jobs and were dedicated to serving this country and to help improve this country's governmental systems. The second tipping point came when it became clear that the former United States Digital Service would be asked to become more involved with DOJ's activities. And those activities are the antithesis of what United States Digital Service was founded upon and what the mission has been: to do the most good for the most amount of people, to go where the work is, and to hire and empower great people, which means supporting our agency partners and uplifting the federal servants. I realized that my actions would, if I stayed, would just further legitimize DOGE and potentially cross extreme ethical and legal lines.
Cross ethical and legal lines how?
Some of the activities that DOGE has currently been focused on are gaining access to government systems that house the American people's data. And with that, it is unclear whether they are upholding privacy and security standards that are regularly practiced throughout the government before the new administration came in. There's a high risk of the American people's data being exposed or being utilized for nefarious means. And it also creates the opportunity for potential foreign actors to come in and get access to that data as well. That is completely across the line, both legally and ethically, and something I realized I could no longer do good from the inside and that I must leave.
DK was, until earlier this week, an employee at the Department of Government Efficiency. She, along with 20 of her colleagues, left DOGE in protest. Thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And on the platform X, Elon Musk suggested the staffers would have been fired had they not resigned. White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt responded to the mass resignation in a statement saying, quote, "Don't let the door kick you on the way out."
Men put behind bars for life in Israel are now free. It's the price Israel has paid to secure the release of the hostages from Hamas in Gaza. And that means some Palestinians serving life sentences for suicide bombings 20 years ago have been released. NPR's Daniel Estrin met one of them.
One by one, visitors greet a man they haven't seen in 20 years. Here's one shaking his hand, giving him kisses on each cheek. They're lining up, giving him a pat on the back. Are these friends, neighbors, relatives?
No.
These are his cousins. These are his uncles.
I'm with producer Nuha Musleh in a living room in Hebron in the Israeli-occupied West Bank. The curtains are drawn. Israel prohibits celebratory gatherings for the freed prisoners. Soldiers have come here repeatedly since the prisoner was freed earlier this month.
I am Iyad Abdul Matir Rajab Abu Shkedim, Medina Khalil.
I am Iyad Abu Shkedim from the city of Hebron.
He sits next to me on a couch on his third day out of prison. He says, "We as Palestinians and any occupied people in the world have the legal right to resist the occupier." I ask about his role. He says, "I participated in the Intifada of the early 2000s, just like any other Palestinian. It was the Palestinian uprising with suicide bombings of Israeli buses and cafes." This was the Israeli TV broadcast in August 2004, a double bus bombing in Be'er Sheva, a quiet desert city. 16 Israelis were killed. Hamas claimed responsibility. An Israeli military court found Abu Shechedam guilty of preparing the two suicide belts. He got 18 life sentences. He was 29 years old then. Today, he's nearly 50. I asked if he thought about what he had done during his years in prison. He didn't want to answer. He wanted to talk about prison. He said the hardest period was after Hamas attacked Israel, October 7th, 2023. Israeli prison authorities took away TVs and access to a lawyer. Inmates got a minimum caloric intake. He lost about 45 pounds. He knew nothing about what had happened in the war. The day of his release this month, he says he was taken to a tent and shown images of Gaza, the Israeli army moving through the streets, bodies scattered on the ground. Israel's prison services denied this is what freed prisoners are shown and declined further comment. He says he was in shock. He didn't know if any of it was real. It was the first time he learned what had happened in the war. Now there's a ceasefire, with the release of Israeli hostages and Palestinian prisoners like him. He says, God willing, after this war, everything will be over. This is an Israeli radio interview with Chaim Uzan. His father was one of the victims of the double suicide bombing Abu Shechedam was convicted for. He said his dad had forgotten his grapes on the bus. When he got back on, the bomber blew himself up. His dad's glasses and watch survived. Nothing remained of his body. In the radio interview, Uzan says of the man who prepared the explosives, he was supposed to rot in prison, but, and there's a big but, he wasn't freed for no reason. Three Israeli hostages were freed in exchange. Uzan says, inside Israeli prison, he would stay alive. Now that he's freed, his role is known, to murder more Jews. He'll do that, and he'll be a target, and I believe that way he can die. His family should be killed too. In the family's home in Hebron, we ask one more question. Did he have any message to tell the families of those whose loved ones were killed in the bus bombings 20 years ago? He says Israeli troops killed his brother during a clash in the city in 2000. What should the world say to my father? He says, we too are a bereaved family. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Hebron.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on Thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. The Food and Drug Administration has canceled an important upcoming meeting about vaccines. The surprise decision is intensifying concerns about the Trump administration's approach to vaccines here in the United States. NPR Health correspondent Rob Stein joins us now. And Rob, I want to start with this meeting. Tell us who was supposed to meet and why.
This is a committee of independent outside experts that advises the FDA about vaccines of all kinds, called the Vaccines and Related Biological Products Advisory Committee. People might remember this committee from the pandemic. This was the committee that reviewed all the COVID-19 vaccines for the FDA. It was supposed to meet March 13th to review the latest data about several vaccines and, most importantly, make a key decision about next season's flu vaccines.
Well, tell us about that. What exactly was the committee supposed to decide about the flu vaccines?
The committee planned to make a recommendation on the composition of the next flu vaccines, which strains of the flu virus to target in the vaccines to try to make the shots as effective as possible. The experts review all the latest data about which strains are circulating and make their best guess about which are most likely to be spreading next fall and winter to get the best possible match. This is something that happens every year around this time, and the timing is crucial because it takes months to produce enough vaccine. So the process has to start early or else the vaccine will be too late to protect people.
Okay, and if there's a long-standing order of operations here and vaccine production is reliant on this decision, I would imagine that this meeting being canceled is not going over particularly well in the scientific community.
No. The cancellation of this advisory meeting is raising a lot of concerns among infectious disease experts, public health advocates, and others. I talked with Dr. Paul Offit. He's a vaccine expert at the University of Pennsylvania who's been on the committee for years.
Well, it was disappointing that they canceled this advisory committee meeting. We have met every March for the last decade and longer. I think there's a value in having an independent committee that looks at the data, holds it to a very high standard. That's the process that makes sure that we can have the best science behind the decisions we make.
He worries that next season's flu vaccines may not be ready in time or may not be the best match. And this development comes on the heels of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention canceling a similar meeting.
Also, as Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is taking charge of the Health and Human Services Department.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the HHS oversees both the FDA and CDC, and Kennedy is an outspoken critic of vaccines, and he's also criticized these committees specifically. During his confirmation hearings, Kennedy argued he was supportive of vaccines, but he didn't really renounce any of the previous false claims he'd made about them. Dr. William Schaffner is an infectious disease doctor at Vanderbilt University.
All of us have concerns about vaccine policy going forward, and the more we conform to the routine way of doing things, the more reassured we will be that vaccines will continue to be available, as they should be, to the American public.
He points out that the U.S. is in the midst of one of the worst flu seasons in years. Vaccination rates are down, and a big outbreak of measles, a disease that has come back because not enough parents are getting their kids vaccinated, has already claimed the life of one child in Texas.
Well, Rob, what is HHS saying about the shot for next flu season?
The Health and Human Services Department is promising the FDA will make a decision about the next flu vaccine composition in time to make sure the shots are ready. And a federal official who is not authorized to speak publicly told me the FDA would consult with the CDC, vaccine companies, and others to make that decision.
NPR Health correspondent Rob Stein. Rob, thank you.
You bet.
President Trump has repeatedly floated the idea of transforming Gaza into a seaside resort by permanently relocating about 2 million Palestinians to neighboring countries like Egypt. That is unacceptable to many people in the Middle East, including to many people in Egypt. NPR international correspondent Aya Betraoui has been reporting in Cairo and joins us now. Hey, Aya.
Hey, Elsa.
Okay, so Trump says moving Palestinians out of Gaza will bring them a better life. It will lead to peace. What are you hearing from people in Egypt about that?
Well, I know you said many people in Egypt, but I'll say basically no one in Egypt, not the public, not the presidency, agrees that with Trump on this plan. This is viewed as extremely destabilizing to Egypt's national security. You know, Egypt borders Gaza, so any displacement of people across that border, voluntary or forced, okay, would be seen as Egypt helping Israel remove Palestinians from their land. I spoke with Egypt's former foreign minister and a former ambassador to the U.S., Nabil Fahmy.
First issue is you cannot, by use of force, simply erase the Palestinians. We won't accept that, because then you're applying that standard throughout. Secondly, we would be implicitly or explicitly participating in a premeditated process and policy to expel Palestinians and to erase their cause. We're not participating in that.
And Elsa, people here say that pushing Palestinians out of Gaza would also unravel Egypt's peace treaty with Israel. Now, that 45-year-old peace accord is the bedrock of U.S. foreign policy in the region.
Okay, so then what can you tell us at this point about Egypt's efforts to push back on Trump's idea?
So I spent the week here talking to people, and here's what I got. Egypt is formulating an Arab counterproposal, and we can look at this as happening in three tracks. The first one is reconstruction. How do you rebuild from the ashes? Almost all of Gaza's buildings are damaged or destroyed. You know, tens of thousands of people were killed. So first you have to look at where Palestinians could live in Gaza as the territory is being rebuilt. How do you repurpose all of that rubble? What kind of companies are going to be involved? The second track being examined here is something conceptual. It looks at the bigger picture of, for example, who's going to oversee the tens of billions of dollars needed to rebuild, what levers of accountability are going to be in place to address donor concerns over corruption, ensure transparency, what role would a transitional Palestinian authority without Hamas or the deeply unpopular Palestinian Authority have, and what role is the U.S. and countries like China and Russia going to play? Now, this plan draws from Europe's recovery after World War II and more recent examples like Bosnia, and I was leaked a copy of this plan and actually able to reach its author, Ayman Ismail. Now, he's a Harvard-educated real estate developer in Egypt, an industrialist, a strategist, and he says Trump's plan cannot bring peace, so he's bringing forth solutions that actually have a chance to succeed.
All that I was trying to do is to sort of say, by the way, the world have managed to solve problems similar like that. I mean, US itself led the Marshall Plan to rebuild Europe. So we could actually do the same.
I mean, yeah, any rebuilding plan will need the backing of not only Trump, but also Israel and other Arab states, right? So how is Egypt addressing that?
Exactly. Also, the third track is arguably the hardest, and this is the political track. So I met with Egyptian intelligence officers who have spent decades mediating directly with Israel or between Palestinian factions in Israel, and they say the only solution is a comprehensive and lasting peace between Arabs and Israel that can only happen with a Palestinian state. Now, here, this is not just wishful thinking. Egypt is working closely with regional players like Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and other Gulf states to formulate the outlines of a political roadmap and a framework for rebuilding Gaza, and that is going to be front and center when all the Arab League leaders meet here and converge in Cairo in 5 days to make clear that they reject Palestinian displacement and that they can come up with their own solutions.
That is NPR's Aya Batraoui in Cairo, Egypt. Thank you so much, Aya.
Thanks, Elsa.
Says NPR News.
Steve Inskeep sits down with Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez for a conversation about Trump 2.0.
I think that this is what authoritarians do. I think this is what kleptocracies do. I believe that this is what corrupt administrations do. They rely on the illusion of power.
Tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. A new album was recorded in empty spaces, including the home studios of famous musicians.
It's a protest against proposed changes to British copyright laws around AI.
It challenges you to imagine a world in which there was no music because it's been so devalued that no one can make a living making it.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. Britain's Prime Minister made a visit to Washington today, urging President Trump to remain cautious as he attempts to end the biggest conflict in Europe since World War II. UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer used a combination of flattery and straight talk to try and convince Trump not to abandon Ukraine, saying ending the war can't be peace that rewards the aggressor, Russia.
I see the growing threats we face, and so the UK is all in. This year we'll be giving more military aid to Ukraine than ever, and just this week I've set out how we're shouldering more of the security burden. We're already one of the biggest spenders in NATO, and now we're going much further, delivering Britain's biggest sustained increase in defence spending since the Cold War.
Starmer said American leadership would be critical to maintain the peace in Ukraine. The Trump administration has been dismantling the U.S. Agency for International Development. The agency's headquarters have been closed for weeks, but today, some workers were finally able to clean out their desks. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
Employees who have been fired or put on administrative leave were told to show up at the Ronald Reagan building at an appointed time and given 15 minutes to clear their desks. Former USAID Administrator Samantha Power was greeting them in the lobby.
The manner in which this is being done is the exact opposite of USAID's mission. USAID's mission is about elevating human dignity, and this is about trampling it at every turn.
She says the Trump administration has been moving fast in what she calls the ultimate shock and awe approach, not letting the courts and supporters of USAID on Capitol Hill to get their bearings. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
You're listening to NPR News. Mardi Gras celebrations are underway in New Orleans, and this year more parades are banning those plastic beads in an effort to cut down on waste. From member station WWNO, Matt Bloom has more.
At least two Mardi Gras parades have stopped using plastic beads because they can end up in landfills or clog the city's drainage system. Instead, they're throwing more useful things like jambalaya seasoning.
It's delicious.
Sivia Hebert is on the sidewalk with her husband, Tommy, and daughter, Lucy. The family's keeping an eye out for chocolate-covered moon pies.
Cookie.
What kind?
I like a marshmallow cookie.
There's only one kind. It's moon pie.
Mardi Gras typically produces more than 2 million pounds of waste, but organizers hope the bead bans can start to help cut down on that. For NPR News, I'm Matt Bloom in New Orleans.
Transgender troops are now being identified for removal under orders from the Pentagon. Defense Department leaders have 30 days to identify and remove troops diagnosed with or being treated for gender dysphoria. Transgender troops make up a small fraction of the more than 2 million American service members, but Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth says gender dysphoria is incompatible with military service. Stocks finished sharply lower on Wall Street today. The Dow lost 193 points. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Cunard, offering travelers an opportunity to voyage aboard Cunard's Queen Elizabeth to Alaska. Guests can experience Glacier Bay National Park and Hubbard Glacier, as well as locally sourced cuisine. Learn more at Cunard.com. And from Indiana University, establishing the IU Launch Accelerator for Biosciences to drive healthcare discoveries and train the next generation of innovators. More at go.iu.edu/IULab.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. President Trump confirmed today that the U.S. will hit Canada and Mexico with 25% tariffs starting March 4th. Trump has also threatened to raise tariffs on China by an additional 10%. Writing on Truth Social, Trump cited drug smuggling and overdose deaths as a major justification for the trade fight. But federal data shows that drug smuggling has already dropped dramatically, and overdose deaths are also falling at an unprecedented rate. NPR addiction correspondent Brian Mann joins us now. Hi, Brian.
Hi there, Elsa.
Okay, let's start with Trump's rationale here. Why does he say these tariffs make sense?
Well, President Trump pointed again today to the carnage caused by street drugs, which he says are coming into the U.S. from these three countries. Here he is speaking in the Oval Office.
The drugs continue to pour into our country, killing hundreds of thousands of people. We're losing substantially more than 100,000 people. I mean, dead. They're dead.
Now, the problem here, Elsa, is that President Trump is citing numbers that are out of date. Fatal overdoses have actually been plunging. Deaths from fentanyl and other street drugs last year dropped by nearly a quarter. That's according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, killing fewer than 87,000 people a year. Now, that's still a lot, but Trump is punishing these three countries right now at a time when we're already seeing unprecedented improvements.
Okay, what about smuggling? Let's start with Canada. Like, are criminal gangs in Canada playing a big role in supplying fentanyl and other drugs?
The answer is no. It's almost zero, according to data from U.S. Customs and Border Protection. The northern border does see some migrants crossing without legal status, but the flow of hard street drugs like methamphetamines and fentanyl from Canada, it's a tiny fraction of what we see coming in from Mexico. The president was asked about this today, and he argued drugs are flowing across the northern border without being detected.
But they should be apprehending much more because a lot comes through Canada. And as Mexico gets stronger in terms of the border, it goes up to Canada.
Trump offered no evidence to back up that accusation, and the experts I've interviewed don't think Canada is a factor in the U.S. overdose crisis. Despite that fact, Canada's Prime Minister Justin Trudeau is promising to do even more, boosting security along the border, but that apparently wasn't enough to satisfy President Trump.
Okay, that's Canada. What is the situation on the southern border with the Mexican cartels?
Yeah, here again, there's been enormous pressure on the drug cartels over the last few years. Big arrests, more action by Mexico's government. Officials I talked to in the U.S. and public health responders say it's having a big effect. Fentanyl smuggling last month was down 50% compared to a year earlier. That's according to U.S. Customs and Border Protection. People who test drugs around the U.S. also say fentanyl is less potent and less pure. That may be a factor saving some of these lives. No one thinks the drug cartels are out of the fentanyl and drug business, but we're seeing progress. And again, President Trump signaling it's just not enough.
Can you just talk more broadly, Brian, about the Trump administration's overall approach to addiction and overdoses? Like, what strategies do you see emerging in the second term?
Yeah, this is interesting. Most of the focus from the Trump administration so far has been on this foreign policy piece, tariffs, and also threats of military action against the cartels. What we don't know yet, Elsa, is what the Trump team's going to do with big public health changes under the Biden administration that really seem to have brought down overdose deaths. And the big question I'm hearing is what's going to happen to Medicaid. Medicaid is now the largest funding source for addiction recovery care in the U.S. So while the president talks about tariffs, the uncertainty I'm hearing is about funding and support for addiction health care.
That is NPR's Brian Mann. Thank you so much, Brian.
Thanks, Elsa.
The Trump administration is still battling court cases about the way it has dismantled the U.S. Agency for International Development. But one thing is already clear. The headquarters are gone. They've been shuttered for weeks, and just today, employees were given a chance to clear out their desks. NPR's Michelle Kellerman was there.
Applause broke out in the lobby of the Ronald Reagan building each time USAID officials walked out of the elevators with bags of pictures, posters, and other knickknacks from their time in public office.
Just seeing my former colleagues walk out with their possessions, some of whom have worked here 30 years, and seeing a lot of tears and a lot of heartache.
That's Samantha Power, who ran USAID in the Biden administration. Employees, some of whom were fired on Sunday night, some of whom are still working for the agency but on administrative leave, were given just 15-minute time slots to clear out their desks.
The manner in which this is being done is the exact opposite of USAID's mission. USAID's mission is about elevating human dignity, and this is about trampling it at every turn.
There's a woman who came here as a refugee, now serving, she says, to give back to the U.S. Another woman, who also didn't want to give her name for fear of retribution, told NPR she was fired from the Africa Bureau, and she's praying for those whose lives have been touched by USAID.
And I know that we'll find other ways to touch lives.
How long have you worked for USAID?
For USAID, 11 years. As a Fed, 36 years. Didn't think I'd be ending my career like this.
Trump administration officials have branded employees as criminals who are misusing funds. They've canceled contracts. And even after being ordered to pay for some work that has already been done, the administration balked and asked the Supreme Court to weigh in. Samantha Power describes the approach as the, quote, ultimate shock and awe. Another former USAID administrator, Gail Smith, echoes that. She, too, was on hand to see former colleagues packing up.
We'll see what the Supreme Court comes back with, whether that's a catch your breath or they're really going to say it's all right if the U.S. government doesn't pay its bills. I mean, these court cases will be key, and there will be many, many of them.
But in the meantime, she says, the U.S. government is losing a lot of expertise.
From a foreign policy point of view, this is crazy. You don't just cut off your arm and say, well, we'll figure out later whether or not we needed it.
She worries that scenes like this could turn young people away from public service.
Thank you for your service.
Outside, we meet Celia, who's asked that we do not use her last name for fear of retribution. She's been working on supporting scientific research around the world, but was fired on Sunday and is here to pick up her belongings.
I think people don't understand the work we do, and so it's easy to ignore. But this is just the first in many, I think. This is an example and a test case of what may come. And that's alarming.
She points out that Congress has the power of the purse, but has not stepped in as the Trump administration fires federal workers and refuses to pay for work already done.
Congress needs to come out and help us, because we're just trying to do the job that they asked us to do, that they've approved for us to do. And that's bipartisan. That's just bipartisan.
Celia doesn't know what she'll do next, but she's talking to her former colleagues who are used to working in difficult places and helping communities in crisis, skills that may now be useful at home. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. A United Nations investigation into Bangladesh's violent response to student-led protests last year found that up to 13% of the victims were children, and that former Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina and her government may have committed crimes against humanity. A warning, this story includes the sounds of gunfire and descriptions of the killing of children. Shamin Chowdhury reports from Dhaka.
Last June, 15-year-old Naima Sultana's cousin filmed her happily singing with her friends. A month later, Naima was dead. I greet Naima's mother, Ainul Nahar, in her third-floor apartment in the Bangladeshi capital, Dhaka. She leads me to Naima's room and points to the bed where she'd been sitting drawing moments before she was killed. Naha shows me mobile phone footage of the protests obtained from a neighbor. A line of police officers and protesters scatter as gunshots ring in the air. She recalls how Naima stepped onto the balcony to bring in some laundry. Naha watched her as she fell onto the floor.
I kept asking Naima what happened, but she couldn't reply. I then saw blood pouring from her head. At that moment, all my dreams were shattered.
Struck by a bullet from the street below, Naima was rushed to hospital, but died within hours. The unrest began as students protested against the way civil service jobs were awarded. It escalated into the ousting of former Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina, who fled to India. A UN investigation found Hasina's government used deadly force against the protesters. The report said that up to 1,400 people had been killed, the majority at the hands of security forces. Parents whose children were killed received the equivalent of just over $4,000 in compensation. Shafiqul Alam, press secretary to interim leader Mohammed Yunus, says the government plans to hold those responsible to account.
They were killing people indiscriminately. There is this shoot on sight order given by the Sheikh Hasina regime. We are investigating each of these cases.
Mohammed Abu Hassan works in a tax office and is also seeking answers. His four-year-old son Ahad was also shot dead while watching the protests from their eighth-floor balcony.
The commotion woke him up from his nap. He's just a child. He was curious, so we all went to take a look.
The bullet hit him from ground level. Doctors tried to save him, but it had lodged in his head.
I brought Ahad up. I fed him. I put him to bed. How then can I explain my sorrow?
UN Special Rapporteur Irene Khan tells me the responsibility lies with the Bangladeshi government.
The most important group of recommendations are about the victims of the attack, that they need justice, they need accountability, they need reparations and direct assistance in many cases.
NPR approached a member of Hasina's political party, the Awami League, for comment, but got no response. Back in her apartment, Naha shows me one of Naima's drawings. It depicts a raised fist, a symbol of freedom in Bangladesh. She says Naima supported the protests, though she didn't join in.
She loved her country.
Despite her loss, Naha is pleased Hasina is gone. She now just wants justice and peace for her family. For NPR News, I'm Shamim Chowdhury in Dhaka, Bangladesh.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. More than 1,000 musicians, including Kate Bush and Annie Lennox, joined forces to release an album this week. They are protesting proposed changes to British copyright laws around artificial intelligence. As NPR's Chloe Veltman reports, the album's 12 tracks have no words or music.
The album features occasional sounds of human life, like someone moving about in squeaky shoes or moving a heavy object. But much of it sounds like everyone left the building but forgot to turn off the mic. The album was recorded in empty spaces, including the home studios of artists like Imogen Heap and composer and pianist Max Richter. Composer Ed Newton-Rex runs a non-profit encouraging AI companies only to train their models on creative works they have permission to use. He came up with the concept for the album, titled Is This What We Want?
Empty studios and empty performance spaces and a negative effect on people's livelihoods. It's meant to symbolise, you know, what we think the result of the government's proposals would be.
The UK is proposing that generative AI companies be allowed to train their models on creative works unless artists opt out. Newton-Rex says British law is just fine as it stands.
UK creators and rights holders already have great control over how their work is used because it is illegal to use it to train a commercial generative AI model without their permission. What the government is suggesting would extract that control from them.
A British government spokesperson says in a statement, the UK's current regime for copyright and AI is holding back the creative industries, media and AI sector from realising their full potential, and that cannot continue. United States laws are not as clear. Cases are currently wending their way through the courts. This silent album is the latest in a series of protests by artists on both sides of the Atlantic. Nate Sloan is a University of Southern California musicologist and co-host of the pop music podcast Switched on Pop. He says Is This What We Want could make a particularly big impact.
It challenges you to imagine a world in which there was no music because it's been so devalued that no one can make a living making it. And that's a really sobering and I think alarming thought.
The UK government spokesperson says no moves will be made to change existing copyright law until the government has a workable plan. And that includes helping rights holders easily license their content. Chloe Veltman, NPR News.
Over the years, our NPR Student Podcast Challenge has brought us amazing youth voices from across the country. And today, we're going to meet some of our youngest champions. NPR's Janet Ujung Lee stopped by a student newsroom in Carlsbad, California, where a class full of 10 and 11-year-old journalists was on a tight deadline, racing to get their next big story out.
All right, guys, let's take a seat. Let's go ahead.
It's before school on a crisp Friday morning. And Andrew Luria is rallying the 20 or so kids in his elementary broadcasting club.
How many of you guys didn't do your homework? My own daughter. You're in trouble.
Their assignment was listening to a podcast. Last year, his daughter Lucy Luria and the students of MAG-TV at Magnolia Elementary School made their own.
So imagine this, you're at a birthday party.
And their story was one of the fourth grade winners of the NPR Student Podcast Challenge.
You're playing with your little sister, bouncing on the trampoline.
You're having the time of your life.
And then, in an instant, everything changes. One wrong bounce, you knock heads with your sister, and you go down for the count.
Their podcast, Bouncing Back, told the story of their classmate, Leland Corman, who experienced a severe brain injury from this trampoline accident.
Leland was in the hospital for 5 months, but he wasn't alone. His parents and his sister were right there beside him. Here's Leland's mom, Maggie.
It's really scary. I didn't know if Leland was going to survive.
In their reporting, the MAG-TV crew followed Leland's recovery, leading up to the moment he left the hospital.
Like, I just love to be at school again and see all my friends.
We wanted to know how these 10 and 11-year-old journalists got the job done.
All right, guys, listen up. Let's develop our podcast idea a little bit more. How's that
when
sound?
He isn't with the kids, Luria is the evening anchor for Fox 5 San Diego. And he trains these fourth and fifth graders like professional journalists.
What other thoughts do you guys have, podcast ideas you have?
Fifth grader Ivan Wayland raises his hand.
Maybe we could do it on the fire and like how it started or something like that.
We visited MAGTV the week wildfires broke out in Los Angeles, just hours north of their school in Carlsbad.
I think it's an important thing when you tell the story is put yourself in the victim's shoes. Imagine having none of your clothes, none of your toys, none of your books, none of your school stuff. In some cases, a school burned down. What do you do?
On the huge whiteboard in the classroom is this month's production calendar. Beneath it, in the right-hand corner, a reminder for students. Ask emotional questions. Fifth grader Gabby DeSaw chimes in.
Like trying interviews like some people that like you would know that like evacuated and like.
Once they agree on their podcast idea, MAGTV students turn to work on their broadcast news show. Today, they're producing a segment called The Lion's Share, where they interview their classmates.
I got a camera.
Did you guys grab mics?
Students dash to the front of the room to grab iPhones and microphones.
Okay, let's go.
The sun's peeping out and students rush outside where their friends are just getting to school.
Mic test 1, 2, 3, okay, mic test.
Yep, 1, 2, 3. Works. All right.
This month's Lion's Share question.
And remember, it's what's your New Year's resolution?
Like a coach, Luria observes from the sideline as the students get to work.
You want to get interviewed?
Hi, Claire. What's your New Year's resolution?
To be amazing.
Cool.
What's your New Year's resolution for this year?
To learn piano lessons.
That's cool. What type of piano songs do you want to learn?
Twinkle, twinkle, little star. Basically all the common ones.
Luria also chimes in on craft.
Don't be afraid to go in there kind of quick and just kind of go right on in nice and tight. But I like how smooth that was. That was really good.
Hi, Lydia. What's your New Year's resolution?
To learn how to sit in my chair at the dinner table properly.
All this training from a professional journalist paid off. Our judges could hear the meticulous planning and thoughtfulness in last year's award-winning entry.
Leland left Rady's Children's Hospital on June 1st, returning for the first time since that one unlucky day.
We are all so proud of you.
I worked on Leland's podcast. It was a really heartfelt podcast, and it was really fun.
Itzel Moss is in the fifth grade. It's her second year in MAGTV.
Now I'm kind of like a pro, and I'm really having fun.
Back on the blacktop at Magnolia Elementary,
what? Oh.
The school bell interrupts the pros who are hard at work. Lucy, Luria, and the rest of the students are rushing to class.
I'm gonna be so late.
Does this happen every morning?
Yeah. We're always doing line share, and then the bell rings. We're like, oh no.
And then we all run back, and then we're all super tired.
But it's worth it.
Yeah, it's definitely worth it. We always have so much fun. Yeah.
Janet Wujang Lee, NPR News, Carlsbad, California.
Thank you for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Support for NPR comes from the station and from Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, which monitors safe driving habits to determine a personalized rate at progressive.com. Not available in California or from all agents. From USPS, USPS Ground Advantage service keeps customers in the know when their shipment leaves the dock, when it's on the move, and when it's delivered. Learn more at usps.com/in-the-know. From the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR be the model for high-quality journalism in the 21st century. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering...
I've been to the nation, and I've been to the territory. I've been to the nation, I've been to the territory. And I'm a hard luck guy, get the devil everywhere I go.